Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How has Dallas come to terms with being the city where John F. Kennedy was killed? November will mark the 50th anniversary of the most recent presidential assassination in American history. And as the city prepares what Mayor Mike Rawlings promises will be a serious, respectful, and understated public memorial, Dealey Plaza and the Texas School Book Depository Building will play key roles as some of the most visited destinations for visitors to Dallas. Today, it seems natural to have kept these sites intact as places for the reflection on the sad events. But as my guest today will tell us, their existence in the present became possible only after a great deal of earnest debate and then of hard work by those who believed they were too important to be destroyed. Stephen Fagan is associate curator and oral historian for the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza. His new book is called Assassination and Commemoration, JFK, Dallas, and the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza. Stephen, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
So I had assumed the Texas School Book Depository was some kind of public building, but in fact it was owned by a private company at the time of the assassination. At what point after that did the business sort of pick back up again?
Well, at the time of the assassination, it was a privately owned company that occupied the building, the Texas School Book Depository Company, which was a distribution warehouse for school textbooks. And they began, and they continued in operation after the assassination. They had to do a certain, a few things to protect the integrity of their business and the building. For one thing, they had to start locking the door to keep curious tourists out of the space after the assassination. The sixth floor remained a crime scene for investigators and later for the Warren Commission in 1964, but the Texas School Book Depository Company continued to occupy the building until 1970. When they moved out, they built a new warehouse on Ambassador Row. Whether or not they moved out in 1970 as a result of exposure because of the assassination is still up for debate. But once the building was vacated in 1970, that's when the real question began. What do we do with this very important site in downtown Dallas?
Yeah, it's interesting that the debate started then because I guess while it was still working, people figured, well, somebody has a business here and they've got to get going. When the debate started, talk about the pros and cons that people felt within the city with regard to whether it should just be razed or it should be converted into some other function.
Well, starting immediately, literally the day after the assassination, Dealey Plaza became the city's most visited site. During the weekend of the assassination, there were flowers and note cards all over Elm Street, and the Texas School Book Depository was very much at the center of that experience. It was estimated that about a million people a year came to the plaza, and they wanted to see that building. They tried to get inside that building, and once the building was empty, then people began to question, you know, what purpose is it serving? And that would we'll see that throughout this long debate. What purpose does this building serve for Dallas? Those who argued that the building should not be there fell back on the old argument that it's a painful reminder of the assassination. It's an eyesore at the edge of downtown. It really doesn't serve any function. But that building represents something. It's a manifestation of evil. It's a reminder to Dallasites that we failed and President Kennedy died here in this spot. And there were those, slowly at first, a small network of grassroots community leaders who started to look at that building and think about the larger issues of preservation and recognizing tragedy and embracing tragedy and finding Dallas's place in that dark history.
How did the ongoing renovation of Ford's Theater throughout the 60s to become a museum influence the debate here?
It was very important to the public works director, Judson Shook. Judson was really the one who stepped up to the plate and recognized, you know, this building is in imminent danger of being demolished. No one else is doing anything about it. Dallas County really needs to step in and protect this building. It was Judson Shook's idea to relocate the headquarters for Dallas County, the seat of Dallas County government, inside the Texas School Book Depository, which in the mid-1970s seemed like a ludicrous ludicrous plan to many people. But Judson began to look at Ford's Theater specifically. He paid a visit to Ford's Theater. He talked to the curator there, found out the long and tangled history of that theater. It had been closed. It had become an Army Medical Museum. It had become warehouse space. And finally, about 100 years, you know, after Lincoln's assassination, it was finally recognized as a historic site worth preserving and transforming into a museum about Lincoln and his death and a fully functioning theater. So Judson Shook paid careful attention to that and used that as an argument when he went to meet with county officials to try to convince them that, yes, this building needed to be preserved and it could serve an active role as the seat of county government.
Why, Stephen, did the assassination of President Kennedy stick to Dallas in a more profound way than other presidential assassinations seem to have done with the cities where they took place?
Well, that's a great question, and that's at the heart of the soul-searching that many in the community had in the aftermath of the assassination. To fully recognize the reasons behind that, we have to look back before the assassination at Dallas's political reputation nationally. Dallas was and is a conservative community. That's the reality. But in the early 1960s, there was fringe extremist groups in the community that really darkened the city's political reputation. The John Birch Society had 700 local members. They had a headquarters and a bookstore here in Dallas. There were a number of larger-than-life ultra-conservative personalities like Major General Edwin Walker, who lived on Turtle Creek. And
also interestingly tied into this story.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. He flew his American flag upside down as a sign of distress, fearing that the United States was in danger of being taken over by communism. And there was Congressman Bruce Alger, the first Republican congressman here since Reconstruction, who was considered to be the most conservative congressman in the United States at that time. Dallas.
He was the Ted Cruz of his day.
Yeah, I guess so. It's interesting that in the 1960 presidential election, Texas went for John F. Kennedy. However, Dallas supported Republican Richard Nixon by the largest margin of any city in the United States. And these political leanings were recognized nationwide. But it was several prominent incidents that really gave people this impression of Dallas, which led to the term City of Hate, City of Vitriolic Tenor after the assassination. During the last days of the 1960 election, Lyndon Johnson and his wife Lady Bird were here, and they were accosted by demonstrators crossing the street from the Baker Hotel to the Adolphus Hotel. They were kicked and spit on. By some accounts, those reports are exaggerated, but Johnson certainly used that to great political advantage in the last days of the election. In 1961, the Dallas Morning News publisher Ted Dealey publicly insulted Kennedy at a White House luncheon, telling him that we needed a man on horseback rather than someone riding Caroline's tricycle. And then finally, just 1 month before the assassination, UN Ambassador Adlai Stevenson was here for a speech at Memorial Auditorium on UN Day, and he was very famously captured in films and photographs, hit on the head with a placard and spit on. And this was the atmosphere in Dallas. Fringe extremists, small pockets, a vocal minority, blackened the city's reputation. And after Kennedy was shot here, the prevailing notion nationwide was, oh, Dallas. That's mm-hmm. where things like this happen. Mm-hmm. And it took years, decades, arguably, for the city to overcome that stigma.
And even during the trial proceedings for Jack Ruby, there were jail escapes. And that phrase, oh, Dallas, was actually part of a headline, right?
Right. The 1964 trial of Jack Ruby was heralded as the trial of the century at the time, and the very flamboyant San Francisco defense attorney Melvin Belli really had a vendetta against Dallas, particularly after Jack Ruby was found guilty of murder with malice. He railed against the city, and he declared Dallas on live television to be a city of hate, a city of shame forevermore, and that did Dallas no favors as it was beginning to try to recover its reputation in the aftermath of the assassination.
I know that historians are reluctant to play what if, but I have to wonder if the assassination had somehow not taken place here, if that reputation that Dallas grew to have would have really been part of the culture in the way that it was. People might have thought, you know, would they have looked upon Dallas and not have instantly thought throughout the remainder of the 1960s, that's a, you know, an ultra-conservative city. And not just ultra-conservative, but people thought of Dallas as a place that was really filled with hate that may not have accurately reflected the sentiments of much of the community.
Yeah, it is difficult to imagine what the city's reputation would have been like, particularly politically, had President Kennedy not been assassinated here. It's certainly, whether or not you agree with Dealey Plaza and the preservation of the depository, it certainly colored the image of Dallas and was the defining moment in mid, you know, 20th century politics in the city's history. I think in talking to people, one of my jobs at the museum is our ongoing oral history project. I interview people from around the world about their thoughts on President Kennedy and the assassination, and I'll often ask them about their feelings about Dallas prior to the assassination. What do you think of the community? I ask local residents that, but I also ask people from other parts of the United States and overseas. And the notion is, well, you know, they Dallas fit the Western, Midwestern stereotype that they associate, you know, from television and popular culture. They recognized that Dallas was fiercely conservative, and some of them did think about Adlai Stevenson or the Johnson incident because those gained national headlines, and it was featured on, you know, Good Morning America and Walter Cronkite's program and Time Magazine and Life. But they didn't really associate Dallas negatively with arch conservative activism. That really did start after the assassination when reporters from around the world and over 300 reporters descended upon Dallas police headquarters within 24 hours of the Kennedy assassination. And with little new information to share, they began parroting these stories, Dallas's recent political history. And that sealed its fate. That created an image of Dallas that was unshakable in the minds of most Americans.
So the first person to have an inchoate plan, but a plan to make the sixth floor, the Texas School Book Depository into a museum site, was someone that a lot of Dallasites might have forgotten.
Yes, State Senator Mike McCool, as far back as 1968, recommended that the state of Texas should get a hold of the depository through eminent domain or through purchase or however, whatever means necessary. And he wanted to transform the school book depository into one of the greatest museums in the world, is what he said. And he was essentially just the whole proposal was laughed at. No one was thinking about that very seriously as far back as 1968. He took it to the state legislature. Two state senators threatened to filibuster the bill. A letter from one of President Kennedy's closest aides, Ted Sorensen, was read aloud on the Senate floor, condemning the idea, talking about how extremely inappropriate that idea would be. And it essentially died in committee. Ultimately, the governor of Texas did appoint a panel to discuss a state memorial to President Kennedy, but from the very outset, they were thinking about a living memorial in terms of a student scholarship or a day of mourning or something like that. They never really considered Mike McCool's plan to take the Texas School Book Depository and transform it into a museum, but he certainly was ahead of his time in his thinking on that.
Then a couple of years later, the company moves to a different location. The building is up for sale, and in comes someone from, of all places, Nashville, Tennessee.
Absolutely. One of the most colorful characters in this story, a Nashville music promoter named Aubrey Mayhew, who was a conservative Republican, but he loved President Kennedy. And he came down here for the public auction on a whim and discovered that, for the most part, people were making fun of the idea of buying the Texas School Book Depository. There were some people that were interested in the building. There was a textbook distribution company interested in using it for the exact same purpose mm-hmm. as the Texas School Book Depository. There was another man who was interested in simply tearing down the building and selling souvenir bricks. I think he was from Pennsylvania. And Aubrey Mayhew recognized this was a historic site. As colorful as Aubrey Mayhew is, we have to recognize he did, in many respects, save the building from its fate right then in 1970. He bought the building for about $500,000 and proceeded to outline plans for what eventually became, in his mind, an $18 million museum and research complex that would occupy much of Dealey Plaza. His goals were ambitious, but no one locally took him seriously, and everyone began at that moment to become very afraid of what is happening here. You know, this building is suddenly in danger of commercial exploitation.
My guest is Stephen Fagan, associate curator and oral historian for the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza. His new book is called Assassination and Commemoration. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stephen Fagan, associate curator and oral historian for the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza. His new book is called Assassination and Commemoration. He will hold a conversation tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock at the museum with Conover Hunt and Linda Lynn Adams. You can find information about that on the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza website or on the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to be part of this conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@KERA.org. Okay, so we left off with Aubrey Mayhew buying the building. Things quickly began to fall apart for him.
Right. He had very ambitious plans for a private museum and research center. He even spoke to a Dallas architect and sort of outlined what his vision would be. He wanted a private apartment for himself on the seventh floor, and he wanted the first through the sixth floors to be the story of John F. Kennedy's life, starting with childhood all the way up to the sixth floor, which would be dramatically vacant to embody the story of the assassination. Mayhew was an obsessive collector of Kennedy memorabilia. He had rough drafts of Kennedy's speeches. He had the shell of one of Kennedy's earliest PT boats, not the famous PT-109, but one of his earlier commands. By one count, his collection was estimated at 200,000 artifacts, and he wanted a place to share these with people. But because of his background and credentials as a music promoter from Nashville, people got the impression that Aubrey was a carnival barker and what he was creating in Dealey Plaza would be a circus that would further embarrass Dallas. So he found no financial backing, and slowly his dreams began to crumble.
What is your sense of him as a person and his motivations?
Aubrey passed away in 2009. I only got the chance to meet him once, and he struck me as a very kind, incredible person, and I feel that his heart was in the right place. I think he recognized that the building needed to be saved. He took active steps to ensure it was saved. Like him or not, if it weren't for Aubrey Mayhew, it's very likely the Texas School Book Depository would have been torn down in the very early 70s. But ultimately, Aubrey lost the building. There was an arson attempt on the building, and Aubrey's caretaker, Wynn Anderson, was arrested for that. He later said that he did it simply because he felt like Aubrey had left him high and dry on the failed museum project and it wasn't going anywhere. Aubrey lost the building. He defaulted on his loan in 1972, and it reverted back to the previous owner, who immediately announced that he would sell it to anyone that was interested, first come, first serve, and he hoped to get $1 million for it.
All right. So before we talk about what would become the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza, many people are probably saying, wait, but there was another monument under construction. There's this Philip Johnson structure that remains to this day downtown. And for some reason, for many people, has failed to connect in the profound way that perhaps its planners had hoped.
Yeah. Immediately after this assassination, the city of Dallas wanted to respond to the tragedy in some way. In 1966, they erected two bronze markers in Dealey Plaza near the statue of George Bannerman Dealey to recognize that the assassination took place there. But they wanted to create a memorial to President Kennedy, and that began in the immediate aftermath. Due to a number of delays, the Philip Johnson-designed cenotaph was not actually dedicated until 1970, but it's behind the old red courthouse near Dealey Plaza. The reason I feel that that memorial doesn't connect with people is they're not sure what to expect. They approach this cenotaph, and the concept of cenotaph is lost on many people. It means empty tomb, a memorial, a shrine for someone whose remains lie elsewhere. You walk into this, and I think people might expect to find a picture of Kennedy, a bust, a statue, Kennedy's quotes etched on the walls. Instead, they find a very plain granite slab with Kennedy's name in gold leaf, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, and that's it. It's a spot of quiet contemplation, and on that level, I think it's quite effective. But for tourists who are expecting something more in the lines of a majestic statue of Kennedy or a memorial in that respect, they're disappointed.
So how did the county decide it needed to annex its space and that this place right across from the old Red Courthouse might be an ideal spot?
For the Kennedy Memorial?
I suppose it's not right across, but in the neighborhood of the old Red Courthouse is the Texas School Book Depository building.
The Texas School Book Depository was sitting there. It was vacant despite the owner's attempts to sell it for $1 million. There were no takers. Colonel D. Harold Byrd was the building's owner, had been since 1939. He ran ads in the paper every so often to try to interest people in this historic structure. Judson Shook, with the Public Works Director for Dallas County, decided that the county is in desperate need of expanding its resources. They needed storage space. They needed office space. The city was going through a period of robust expansionism, and this building, he thought it could kill two birds with one stone. It provides space for Dallas County and also end this long-term question of what do we do with this controversial building on the edge of downtown. And so he got the support of Dallas County, and they made it a part, a very small part, of a very large 1977 bond package, which passed. The entire bond package passed without question, and suddenly the Dallas County government owned the Texas School Book Depository.
You say it passed without question. Were voters not particularly aware that this was part of the bond package? Was it not being debated?
I think at that moment, Judson Shook was very shrewd and was brilliant in the way he downplayed the purchase of the depository. He downplayed the possibility of there being an exhibition inside the space. He put people at ease by saying, you know, this will become a part of Dallas County government. This will become a useful part of our expansion. And suddenly the Texas School Book Depository had a use. It would become part of this bureaucratic agenda for Dallas County expansion. And I think in that 1977 bond package, people were much more concerned about the $50 million being spent on the new courthouse complex and bridge and thoroughfare projects and things like that. The cost of this building was minimal compared with the totality of that bond package in 77. Judson Shook played it brilliantly, and as a result, he ultimately saved the building and put it into the hands of Dallas County.
So the building was saved. It, at that point, did it need a great deal of structural reinforcements? Was it in pretty good condition?
No. After the arson attempt in the early 1970s, the building just sat there vacant, and there had been quite a bit of water damage during that arson attempt. The sprinkler system was on and saved the building, but at the same time caused a great deal of damage with the water. Dallas County had to hire a preservation architectural firm here in Dallas, Jim Hendricks and Roger Burson, and they came in and took the building as it existed then in the 1970s and made it into a functioning county office building. They gutted the second floor, created a beautiful two-story commissioner's courtroom. They removed accents from the building that had been added over the years, including architectural accents that were there at the time of the assassination, and they took the building back to its roots as a 1901 warehouse on the edge of downtown.
So the building is saved. There is the sixth floor is there. Talk about the genesis of the conversations that would ultimately lead to the facility that opened in 1989.
The sixth floor museum really began in quiet conversations. No one at the county level really wanted to office in the sniper's perch on the sixth floor. So they recognized that building would be kept, that floor would be kept vacant, even as the county occupied the first five floors of the building. In media interviews I've read over the years, various commissioners at the time voiced their ideas quite creatively about what they wanted to see happen in the space. They wanted it to be kept as a first-class preserve. They wanted a county-run exhibition to be there so people could come into the building and see what happened. But what ultimately became the sixth floor museum at Dealey Plaza really began when Conover Hunt and Lindalyn Adams toured the space. Lindalyn Adams, as many of the listeners probably know, is a very prominent preservation activist here in Dallas, has sat on the board of many cultural organizations. At the time, in the late 1970s, she was chair of the Dallas County Historical Commission, and she was working directly with Dallas County to try and find sites worthy of Dallas County preserving and preserving Dallas County history. She became interested in the building, and she contacted an author and historian from Virginia named Conover Hunt, who came to town, who had recently moved to Dallas. And together, these two women would really lead the charge for the next decade to create an exhibition that would open at the sixth floor, to open on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository. They faced a number of challenges along the way, but they stuck with it for a decade of their lives.
Hmm. So how similar is the sixth floor at this point to what it looked like in November of 1963?
The designers, Staples and Charles, a firm in Washington, D.C., designed the exhibition to make the floor itself our most important artifact. And that's why you still see the original wooden columns. You still see the original light fixtures, the original brickwork. They kept as much of the original sixth floor architecture as possible while changing the space into a gallery of exhibits that chronicles the life, death, and legacy of President Kennedy within the context of 1960s American history.
Mm-hmm. And there were questions about, I guess, the elevators had to be replaced, that sort of thing.
Yes, the depository was a working warehouse, and the freight elevators that were in the building and in use on the day of the assassination, when the county moved in, they had no use for freight elevators, so they ripped out the shaft, but they left the elevator shaft and the elevator permanently located at the sixth floor level. So when our guests step off the external elevator that gets you to the sixth floor exhibition, the first thing you see if you turn to your right is the original freight elevator that was in use and used by employees such as Oswald on the day of the assassination.
How were decisions made about the content that would be featured at the museum? Because you could certainly have gone in a number of different directions. You could have made it something that really didn't focus much on the assassination. It was more about the life of President Kennedy. You could have looked at his political accomplishments. What sort of conversations took place in making those decisions?
There was a great deal of introspection and thought and debate on what to feature on the sixth floor of that building. Certainly Dallas recognized that their place of authority was in the matter of Kennedy's death. The John F. Kennedy Library in Boston chronicles the president's life and times, and the sixth floor team recognized that they didn't want to tread on interpretive material covered by the JFK Library. They also recognized that people coming to the sixth floor came for a variety of reasons. They came because they were inspired by President Kennedy. They were moved by his life. And they recognized that younger visitors to the exhibition would not necessarily appreciate the magnitude, the global significance of the death of this one man without the proper context. So over the course of many years, and it took a decade in active development for the sixth floor to become a reality, they sketched out a number of iterations, and in the book I profile the 1982 and 83 iterations, and then finally what opened in 1989. A few changes here and there, but really the concrete plan was there from the very beginning. They would introduce President Kennedy. They would introduce the culture of the 1960s and what Kennedy represented in the popular mindset. They would follow him through his brief presidency to the trip to Texas, explaining the reasons for it, and then you would arrive at the corner window. You have to understand, in outlining an exhibit on the sixth floor of a 1901 warehouse space, they were working within the geographic limitations of what was available. And with the corner window in the southeast corner being the moment when the assassination took place, they had to construct this narrative arc in such a way that in the narrative, as you're walking along looking at the exhibits, you arrive at the corner window, at the sniper's perch, at the moment that the assassination occurs in the story you're exploring.
Hmm. So, which is a more complicated proposition than it might sound if you haven't had to get everything right.
Absolutely. And Staples and Charles, the design team, made brilliant use of light. Every aspect of the sixth floor was very carefully considered. If you go up there, you look at the museum, and things work. Things have worked for 25 years. The museum's 25th anniversary is next February, and the exhibit is, in many respects, virtually unchanged from 1989, and that's because it works. It speaks to people on a variety of levels, and some of those are subconscious. The designers outline the panels, for example, to resemble 1960s newspaper pages, because that's a comfort zone with which people can navigate and read. So the headings and the subheadings, even the font choice was a 1960s newspaper font. All of that was very carefully chosen because there's a great deal of text. There's about 100 pages of text on the sixth floor, which is quite extraordinary even for a history museum. And yet people stand there and they read it and they explore it and they watch the videos and they listen to the audio tour and they explore the assassination and they spend and upwards of an hour and a half to 2 or 3 hours in that space, recognizing the story, and even for young people born after 1963, appreciating what Kennedy stood for and why his death had such an enormous impact around the world.
The teletype machine is still there, right?
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, the artifacts, when the exhibit opened in 1989, very few artifacts were chosen. Again, the designers, while battling a myriad of outside issues, they were always concerned about representing the assassination and Dallas in a very appropriate way and not being commercial or exploitative in any way. And they were afraid that the inclusion of too many artifacts, particularly violent artifacts like mm-hmm. the gun or artifacts particularly associated with Lee Harvey Oswald or Jack Ruby, might invite comparisons to Ripley's Believe It or Not or something like that. And they wanted to treat everything with respect. The teletype machine is the largest artifact on the sixth floor, and it is representative. It's a very important artifact because it's representative of how the immediate word of the assassination was disseminated across the world.
I was surprised, Stephen, to read in Conover Hunt's introduction to your book that although the museum opened in 1989, it took a long time for Dallasites to start showing up in significant numbers.
Absolutely. When Conover Hunt first came on board, for example, she did a visitor survey in Dealey Plaza. That was her first job, was to go out and basically talk to the people that actually come to the site and say, would you be interested in an exhibition on the sixth floor of this building? Amazingly, she found a 100% interest in a building. Not one single person said they did not want to see an exhibition inside that building. What's interesting is of the tourists that she encountered, only 5% were from the state of Texas. 95% came from outside of Texas, and that's a testament to how this very much is a destination for people outside of Dallas. Sometimes I characterize it as the Statue of Liberty complex. The depository is there. It's been there. It'll always be there. Eventually, local residents will get around to coming and exploring the site. But it's deeper than that, of course. There are painful memories associated with the assassination. In our oral history project, I've talked to a number of people who share heartbreaking stories of traveling outside of Dallas, outside of Texas, and being treated very badly, having change thrown in their face, rocks thrown at their car. The publisher of the Dallas Times-Herald, Jim Chambers, was ordered out of a taxi cab in Detroit snow when the taxi cab driver found out that he was from Dallas. And one of my favorite stories is from a young lady who was about 6 or 7 at the time of the assassination, and she received a Christmas card that year from an East Coast relative addressed to Shame on You, Texas, and it arrived right to her house, and she kept it. So all of these people took the assassination very personally, and I can certainly understand the hesitancy with which they approached the Texas School Book Depository in the sixth floor, but the designers and the entire project team went to great lengths to make it an appropriate experience that does not in any way embarrass Dallas.
Stephen Fagan is my guest. He's associate curator and oral historian for the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza, which tomorrow at 2 will be hosting a conversation between Stephen Fagan, Conover Hunt, and Linda Lynn Adams. The book that he has just written that we're talking about is called Assassination and Commemoration, JFK, Dallas, and the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza. If you want to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Stephen Fagan, who's associate curator and oral historian for the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza. His new book is called Assassination and Commemoration, JFK, Dallas, and the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza. Right now, the book is available only through the museum, but it will hit wide release in early July. If you'd like information about the conversation that Stephen is having tomorrow with Conover Hunt and Linda Lynn Adams, you can call the museum. There may be some tickets available if you call the museum directly. 800-933-5372 is our number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Stephen, how much of the draw to this particular area, rather than just the story itself, has to do with the fact that we have color pictures of the moment that all this happened?
Oh, I think that the film and photographic evidence in the assassination is extremely important to people. The Abraham Zapruder home movie of the assassination is haunting, and it remains one of the most significant home movies of the 20th century. You literally watch the president lose his life. I think that these images help to connect the assassination to people in a way that they don't connect to the Abraham Lincoln shooting or the McKinley shooting or things like that. There were enough eyewitnesses in Dealey Plaza. There's enough film and photographic material of the assassination that creates this tapestry of history, and it's easy to lose yourself in it, especially with unanswered lingering questions and conspiracy theories and things like that. It's easy to get involved in the assassination and recognize the enormous worldwide impact that this had and how it touched people's lives all over the world.
How much thought, ongoing thought, has to be given to the fact that there is a contingent of museum visitors who have firsthand memories of what happened, and there is a ever larger contingent of people like you and me who were born after the president was assassinated?
About two-thirds of our visitors were born after 1963, and our executive director, Nicola Longford, really has an extraordinary vision reaching out to young people, finding ways to keep the assassination relevant through programming, through special events, things like that. The museum recognizes that as time marches on, the audience is changing. When Conover Hunt and Lindland Adams put this exhibit together in 1989, they did so for an audience, two-thirds of which were rememberers who would find a very emotional, personal experience on the sixth floor. That has shifted almost entirely to two-thirds not being alive at the time of the assassination. But I think it speaks to the power that a place like Dealey Plaza has, that it attracts people from around the world, including some 60,000 school kids every year in field trips, coming to a site to see where history happened. There are very few sites on American soil where you can literally point to a geographic location, like a Civil War battlefield, and say, world history changed right here in this spot. And Dealey Plaza is one of those sacred spaces. It's an important component in our tradition of memorializing sites of tragedy. Dealey Plaza is very much in the same vein as Pearl Harbor or the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City or the footprint of the World Trade Center or even Ford's Theater, marking a significant moment when world history changed.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Kevin in North Richland Hills. Hello, Kevin.
Hello. I just wanted to compliment you and say thank you for not changing the display over this period of time of almost 25 years. I moved here in 91 from Canada, so I had a little bit of a different perspective, and I was totally blown away by how well-rounded the display was and how open-minded it was. I moved here, and all my family's saying, oh, yeah, you know, Texans, everybody's got a gun rack, this and that, but I was just totally amazed at how well-rounded the display was, how it had the political climate of the time, the personal climate of the time, and took in all the different theories but did not promote a single one. It really lets the visitor experience all of it and make their own judgment. And that is, you know, that stands the test of time.
Thanks for your call, Kevin.
Yeah, thank you very much. That's a testament to our founders and how they got it right the first time. They really recognized the story they needed to tell, and they told it in a very appropriate way. We have done some exhibit enhancements. We have some more planned for the rest of this year, but the core story always remains the same. A frank and factual exploration of the president's life and times and the death and legacy, and the ongoing legacy of the assassination.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have another Kevin on the line, this time from Dallas. Hi, Kevin.
Oh, hello. I've always enjoyed your show. Nice to talk to you. I was going to ask about a two-part question. Jacqueline Bouvier, I think it was early 80s, I worked downtown, and she would come to the memorial and leave a rose at the county memorial. It was very moving to kind of see her do that ritual, I think, after the, you know, when they refurbished it, I think. And I was also wanted to know what the family, if the family had any involvement, the Kennedy family, in the this museum. And
I appreciate your call, Kevin. We're having a really hard time hearing you, so I'm going to translate for the audience. Someone was asking about Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis in later years leaving a rose at the memorial and whether the family has any ongoing involvement with the museum. Thank you for your call. Sorry about the connection.
That's not anything I'm aware of. I know of no instance where Mrs. Kennedy came back to the state of Texas after the assassination. That might be a rumor or a myth. Certainly, we have photographs of Mrs. Kennedy visiting the president's gravesite at Arlington National Cemetery, but I've not heard of her visiting Dallas or the Kennedy Memorial. As far as the Kennedy family's involvement, certainly this is a sensitive issue for them and something that the founders were very careful to navigate. One of our founding board members was a close friend of the Kennedy family, and she kept them apprised of what was happening. She kept them up to date on progress for the exhibit. But no input or approval was ever sought from the Kennedy family in the development of the displays.
To what extent is this museum really about the city of Dallas itself?
Well, Conover Hunt, in looking at photographs to feature, in personal stories to feature, she wanted to tell the story of Dallas. She wanted to emphasize that it was Dallas law enforcement which captured Lee Harvey Oswald, Dallas law enforcement that conducted that investigation, and local reporters for the Dallas news agencies that really gathered the breaking story of the assassination. For example, when she was working with Antenna Audio to develop the audio tour that you hear when you go through the exhibit, the initial first draft of the audio tour that Antenna prepared called very much for a national story with input from national news media figures and things like that. And Conover sent them back to the drawing board and said, we want to tell a local story. And in the audio tour, which you heard for many years at the museum, the initial audio tour, you heard from Dallas investigators, Dallas residents, Parkland Hospital doctors who worked on the president here. So it very much does tell the story of Dallas without apologizing for Dallas. It acknowledges the political atmosphere in the city at the time of the assassination. But it doesn't linger on Dallas's reputation. It's not an apology for Dallas, and it's not a way for Dallas to speak to this event or speak to its own history. It is a way for people to reflect upon their own lives and the journey that this city has taken. But it's all very subtle. And as I hope I explain in the book, this museum helps, I think, in many ways, Dallas to recognize its place in history and hopefully to come to terms with its place in history all these years later.
There are always these questions about moving on and what that means. And, you know, to the extent that you can never change history, you know, this will remain an integral part of the city's history. But do you find that people remain as engaged with this as they have throughout history since 1963? In other words, is there a sense that Dallasites don't first and foremost sort of have in their definition of themselves the fact that President Kennedy was killed here?
Oh, certainly that's changed over the years. When I talk to local school groups, and I do that quite often at the museum, local students are shocked when I talk about the pain and frustration that Dallasites had to endure in the aftermath of the assassination. So I think that is changing. It will always be a part of our history. Mm-hmm. The assassination, the city's shattered reputation, leading to the Goals for Dallas program and the city's rejuvenation in the late 60s and early 70s, a lot of that can be traced back to the assassination, and it will always be a part of our cultural history. But I think as time marches on, young people are unaware that Dallas had to shoulder so much of the blame for the assassination. And I think in a lot of ways that's a good thing because it means that the city's reputation is recovered to the point where people no longer associate Dallas exclusively with the assassination. A lot of things have changed, let alone, you know, Dallas Cowboys and J.R. Ewing and the Dallas TV series. And in you saw a shift in the late 70s and 80s away from the assassination, more towards embracing America's team, and people began to question who shot J.R. as opposed to who shot JFK.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Mary in Dallas. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Chris. I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say I'm not a native a person of Dallas. I'm from Los Angeles. My husband and I moved there in 94. And one of the first things we did was visit the Sixth Floor Museum. I was about 5 years old when the president was assassinated. And I just want to say from an African-American perspective, when my mom our parents came to visit us here in Dallas. We took them, and now we have teenage children. We've taken them. And I think that there's this, I don't know if that's ever been spoken about, the connection between African-Americans and the love they have for President Kennedy. I think he's one of the first presidents that voters, black voters, may have had an active role in electing. And it's just very emotional to visit it each time I do with different people of different age groups, but mostly African-Americans.
Mary, thank you so much for your call.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's gratifying to hear that she came to the museum and is now taking her children to the museum. It's becoming a generational experience. As far as President Kennedy and his connection to civil rights, that's certainly something we acknowledge in the museum in discussing very briefly in the limited amount of space we have touching on the Kennedy presidency. We do a number of programs each year relating to the civil rights movement. In fact, in June, we have a civil rights activist, Ernest McMillan, coming to the museum, and I'll be interviewing him as part of our Living History series. So certainly we try to recognize as much as possible President Kennedy's commitment to civil rights and include that in the museum's mission.
So I know that you have a year of special programs planned, but can you talk about what's going to happen at the museum but also in the city at large in November?
I can't share a lot of information about what the city's plans are. Certainly the mayor has a 50th committee, and they are planning a ceremony in Dealey Plaza on November 22nd this year. The museum is not involved with that. What we are doing is focusing on our programming. We're doing some updates to our facilities and doing some enhances to our exhibits. But really, we're focusing on our Living History program. Each month this year, starting in January and going all the way through December, we're bringing a special guest to the museum to share in a live oral history. I'll be discussing their memories of the assassination before a live audience, and then the audience will have a chance to become part of that history. We're speaking with a Texas School Book Depository employee who drove Oswald to work that day. We recently spoke with a Marine Corps major who was involved in the Kennedy funeral. We have civil rights activists. We have a Peace Corps activist who was here earlier this year. It's a broad perspective on the president's life and legacy and how people around the world were touched by the assassination. So that continues every month through December, and there's information on our website about that.
Obviously, each person's perspective is going to be different who was a witness to the event in any way. But how often, as you conduct these oral histories, Stephen, does someone say something that makes your ears perk up and you think, I have never heard this before. Now I have to go corroborate what I'm hearing.
Well, I have to say the Oral History Project is near and dear to my heart. I joined the museum staff in 2000, and I've worked on that project ever since. We have almost 1,100 interviews in the collection. And to me, every story is important. It's a piece of this puzzle, this tapestry of living history that we're creating at the museum. And it's broad. It's broad. It ranges from everyone from Walter Cronkite to Lee Harvey Oswald's ninth grade science teacher. Mm-hmm. We talked to a number of young people who were in Dallas and just around the world, and their memories of November 22nd are frighteningly similar, no matter where they were. They heard it from their teacher. They heard it from their principal. It was broadcast on the loudspeaker, and it touched them in a personal way, almost as if a family member had died. And these are stories which the museum is dedicated to preserving because it helps us build bridges of communication to other generations. I was working at the museum on September 11th, and I remember talking to student groups in the aftermath. And these kids, these brilliant kids, would make connections on their own between what we were enduring as a country in the aftermath of 9/11 and what their parents or grandparents went through in the aftermath of the Kennedy assassination. The connections are there, and we try to use the oral histories as a way of enhancing that connection and helping to build those bridges of understanding.
Stephen Fagan is associate curator and oral historian for the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza. His new book is called Assassination and Commemoration, JFK, Dallas, and the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza. There will be a talk tomorrow afternoon between Stephen Fagan, Conover Hunt, and Linda Lynn Adams. You can call the museum for more information about that. There may be some tickets available, but officially, currently, there are very few. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had Joe Bellotti on the phones. Lindsay Connect helped Jeff Whittington as executive producer today. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. You can learn more about the show and find out about upcoming programs at kera.org/think. Send comments, questions, or suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.